from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., an unusual group will read a statement at the National Press Club in Washington condemning the Bush administration's foreign policy and urging America to change direction. Another disgruntled group of Democrats, you might think, but not this time. Tonight on Point, retired senior diplomats and military brass, many with roots in the Reagan and Bush 1 years, call for an end to the with us or against us Bush foreign policy, and the Bush camp fires back. But first, today in Washington, Afghan President Hamid Karzai addressed a joint session of Congress where he thanked the United States for the help it gave Afghanistan to free itself from the Taliban.
Our shared success in Afghanistan is vital to achieving victory over the greatest menace the world faces today, terrorism and extremism.
Later in the day, at a Rose Garden press conference, President Bush held up progress in Afghanistan as a model for Iraq. Paul Richter is Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and has been covering the Karzai visit. I asked him exactly how candid a picture President Bush painted today of what's really going on in Afghanistan.
It was an incomplete picture. He emphasized that the progress that's been made on building roads, opening schools, registering people to vote, creating secure conditions there, but there wasn't a discussion of how far country and this fragile interim government has yet to travel down that road, and it's quite a long way.
What did Hamid Karzai come to Washington seeking?
I think the most important thing he was after was simply to try to strengthen the U.S. commitment to him and to his government. They're heavily dependent on the U.S., and the U.S. has left them in the lurch before. We were heavily involved during the days of the Soviet occupation, and then afterwards we withdrew, and I think Karzai may fear that we may do that again if our concern about terrorism flags.
And what did President Bush offer today?
Bush made a general broad promise to remain committed, and he said that the Afghan government's effort is in many ways the same as the U.S. effort, and he promised to stay with Karzai's government.
President Bush described Afghanistan broadly as a model for Iraq. If that's the case, what kind of model are we looking at here, Paul Richter? What does life look like for the Karzai government and beyond in Afghanistan today?
I think the Karzai government will be very different from the Iraqi government, however that takes shape. Afghanistan has this long tradition of having a weak central government and stronger regional leaders, and I think they're probably going to stick to that kind of model, whereas in Iraq, they have, especially in the recent past, a tradition of a much stronger central government. I think that Karzai or whoever leads the new Afghan government is going to have to try to basically negotiate how much power the central government is going to have over the next period of several years.
President Bush said today that Afghanistan is no longer a terrorist factory sending thousands of killers into the world. You report that it is, however, a tremendous opium poppy factory, the number one supplier in the world for the world's supply of heroin.
Yes, they're producing something like three-quarters of the world's opium poppies now, and they're expected to have an even larger crop this year. So it's a huge issue. The problem is that it would take huge resources to deal with it. And I think the Karzai government would like a commitment from the Americans to take that on, but the Americans have been resisting, knowing that this would require troops and equipment far beyond what they have. I mean, I think even if the Americans took on this project, it would be a matter of doing it over a number of years and finding replacement crops and convincing these Afghan farmers to turn to those crops, which are likely to be considerably less lucrative.
But the U.S. military does help destroy drug crops in South America. They've got nearly 20,000 U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan now. Wouldn't that be enough to make a dent in the poppy production there, the heroin production?
I don't think the Americans are willing to take all those soldiers who are now chasing bin Laden and others and devote them to the drug control issue. I think it would mean more troops. On top of that, and as you know, the American military is stretched everywhere in the world these days. U.S. military views that as several steps further than they really want to go.
Paul, you report also that Afghanistan is dealing with unruly warlords, insurgent attacks, allegations of government corruption. Is this the success that George Bush is suggesting it is?
It's not as far along as he suggests, and there are many, many challenges to Karzai's government that are going to be very difficult to handle. On the other hand, Karzai represents personally a promising leader for the country, and so I think the Americans are pleased at least that they've gotten this far.
Elections set for Afghanistan in September. Is Karzai likely to win those? Will they be held? Is there enough stability and security in the country to go ahead?
It's not clear that they'll be held at the time scheduled. Apparently, there are both parliamentary and presidential elections scheduled for September. It's likely, I think, that at least the parliamentary elections will be delayed. The presidential elections may be delayed as well. It's a question of registering people, but also of assuring security so that people with guns aren't able to intimidate voters and thus influence the outcome of the election.
Paul Richter, thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it.
Paul Richter is Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me from Washington. In Washington, politics as usual, there's always someone holding a press conference to bash an opponent. But there is another Washington, a parallel universe where career diplomats and military brass tend to go quietly about their business, moving through Republican and Democratic administrations, doing their jobs without making waves. Now, a group of retired, high-tier members of that group is rocking the boat. More than two dozen former high-level diplomats and top military brass are speaking out very publicly against the Bush foreign policy and calling for a change of direction and of leadership. This hour, On Point, Diplomats and Military Commanders for Change. What do you make of this top-level pushback on George W. Bush's foreign policy? Is this the revenge of an old guard that just doesn't get it, or wisdom calling for an urgent change of course? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington are members of the group that calls itself Diplomats and Military Commanders for Change. I'm joined from Washington by Charles Freeman, former ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 1989 to 1992 under the first President Bush. He served as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs from 93 to 94 under President Bill Clinton. Good evening and welcome, Ambassador Charles Freeman.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us, retired Air Force General Merrill McPeak, who served as the Chief of Staff for the U.S. Air Force from 1990 to 1994, helping lead the Air Force for President George H.W. Bush in the first Gulf War. Good evening and welcome, General McPeak.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be with you.
Thanks to both of you for being with us. We will hear from more tonight and also from defenders of the Bush administration, but let us get a sense of exactly what's going to happen, Charles Freeman. Tomorrow morning, a statement's going to be read at the National Press Club. And what will the gist of that statement be, and who will the signatories be?
Well, the signatories are roughly 20 officers in the U.S. military and foreign service who for decades served presidents of both parties loyally, who stayed out of politics, and who basically are deeply distressed about the damage that the Bush administration has done to American moral and political standing in the world, and the unnecessary risks that it's taken with the lives of our young men and women on the battlefields of Iraq. I think all of us are people who respect competence and are prepared to cut a lot of slack for politicians within that rubric, but we basically have come to the end of the line.
And Merrill McPeak, what's the bottom line of the statement that we're going to see tomorrow? What does it call for?
Well, I think all of us, you know, have spent a lifetime, a career in advancing the interests of this country, of all Americans, and we see that the tremendous damage that's been done, the torpedoing of the U.S. national interest by this administration, and we're saying enough is enough.
Enough is enough, meaning change the policy, and what about the administration itself?
Well, we need regime change in Washington, and so we're all, active in pointing this out.
Ambassador Freeman, how unusual a step is this in a presidential election year for such high-tier officials from the diplomatic corps, the State Department, the military, to step up with such a public and explicit condemnation of an administration's foreign policy?
I don't think it's ever happened before, and as a career officer who prided myself on my apolitical nature and willingness to follow whomever the American people elected as president, I hope it never happens again. Basically, this administration has tried to practice a diplomacy-free foreign policy, and it has shot first and planned and executed plans for peace later, and that's the wrong approach.
General McPeak, I want to get a sense on the military side of your background and that of some of the other military officers who are signing on. What's the profile of the military signatories?
Well, if you mean professional profile, these are solid guys. They're artillerymen, infantrymen, fighter pilots, destroyer captains who rose to become generals and admirals and retired from a lifetime of service in combat and otherwise to the country.
Who else is on the list, General, from the military?
Joe Hoare, who is a former commander of Central Command. He succeeded to Schwarzkopf, as I recall, commander of Central Command.
The Marine general who was, commander of U.S. forces in the Middle East under President Bush 1.
That's right. Well, he succeeded Schwarzkopf, as I recall it. I've been now retired myself for 10 years, so I'm beginning to lose track of some of the players here.
Yeah, right. He served both Presidents Bush and Clinton in that role.
Right.
And Bill Crowe, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a Navy admiral who had worldwide service, was his commander-in-chief in the Pacific, was commander of naval forces in Europe, very distinguished. As a matter of fact, was ambassador to the U.K. subsequently in retirement, and others. So we have half a dozen or so very distinguished senior military people and perhaps 15 or so former ambassadors.
And Charles Freeman, on the diplomatic and State Department side, give us a sense of who's signing on. Give us some names.
Well, there are a number of people who probably have served their country in times and places of great peril whose names may be known. For example, Bob Oakley, who served in Pakistan as ambassador in Somalia during that intervention, and in many places in Africa. His wife, who was the spokesman for the Department of State, herself an ambassador in several African countries.
Phyllis Oakley,
exactly. And I don't think we need to go through the whole list, but the point is these are some of the most experienced and most senior officers, both in our diplomatic and military ranks. And I think the more interesting thing for your listeners is that we have the sense, certainly from phone calls and from conversations with many of our colleagues who are currently in service still, that while they are in service and therefore can say nothing properly and quite properly do say nothing, our views are not very far from theirs as well.
And you've got William Harrop on here, who was ambassador, of course, to Israel. He says a lot of people felt the work they had done over their lifetime in trying to build a situation in which the United States was respected and could lead the rest of the world was now undermined by this administration, by the arrogance, by the refusal to listen to others, the scorn for multilateral organizations. This is almost undiplomatic language, Ambassador Freeman.
Well, it's a remarkable situation if you think about the immediate aftermath of 9/11. When all of the goodwill and the admiration and the respect for the United States that had been built over previous decades manifested itself in a huge outpouring of international support and sympathy. And where we are now, where all that has to be done to discredit an idea is to have an American speak it.
Charles Freeman, General McPeak, please stand by. We're talking about an outbreak of former senior U.S. diplomats and top military brass calling for an end to the my way or the highway Bush foreign policy. What do you think? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about an unusual outbreak of former senior U.S. diplomats and top military brass calling for an end to the my way or the highway Bush foreign policy. More than that, we are told, tomorrow morning we'll deliver a statement that calls for an end to the Bush presidency. You can join our conversation tonight. What do you make of this top-level pushback on George W. Bush's foreign policy? Is this the revenge of the old guard status quo anti-gang who just don't get the Bush 2 view? Or is Bush foreign policy a runaway train that has to be stopped? Does this group's critique and warning resonate with you? Or are you on board with the with us or against us answer to 9/11? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight by General Merrill McPeak. He was Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force from 1990 to 1994 under Bush 1 and Bill Clinton. By Ambassador Charles Freeman, former Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, 89 to 92, and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for International and Security Affairs. We're joined now from Washington as well by Avis Bolin, Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, 1999 to 2002, and Secondary Affiliation Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs during Bush 1, 1989 to 1991. Good evening and welcome, Avis Bolin.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Just sliding into the studio there in Washington. Avis Bolin, why have you put your signature to this statement?
I think it was a very good initiative on the part of my colleagues, and I wholeheartedly subscribe to the sentiments that are in it, that we have entered a very dangerous period, that we have been led into dangerous policies, and that it is time for a change.
And Charles Freeman, you said earlier that you did this in response to the damage done by Bush foreign policy. How would you define that damage?
Well, you can start by recounting the damage to the credibility of our intelligence, which is now derided rather than respected in many parts of the world. This has complicated our handling of issues throughout the world in places as remote as North Korea, as well as in the Middle East. We had a reputation for being competent and wise. People felt a natural inclination to follow us. That has been reversed. When we call for help, people now ask why they should step up and help Americans. Americans, having through the administration, having gone out of our way, apparently, to stiff-arm them or insult them. Generally speaking, foreign policy is about aggregating allies and partners and friends, not about aggregating enemies and opponents. This administration's been a lot better at generating opposition and enemies than it has been at tending friendships.
And General McPeak, you're not the only military man in this group, but you're with us tonight. What's your assessment from a military angle on the Bush foreign policy? As a general, former Chief of Staff of the Air Force, what's your complaint?
Well, Chas Freeman is absolutely right that the way we make progress internationally is by increasing the number of friends we have and reducing the number of enemies. And this administration has seemed to try to reverse that calculus. The fact of the matter is, if you supported the Bush administration, it's because it's been the kiss of death. I mean, the Spanish government is gone. Tony Blair's popularity is at an all-time low. I was in Rome just recently. The support for the Bush administration there is very unpopular. Now, I spent 11 years in NATO trying to build that alliance. And I don't take kindly to it when our Secretary of Defense says that this is the old Europe and they don't matter anymore.
Well, why should that matter to an American general?
It matters to us. NATO is the most successful military alliance in the history of the world. It won the Cold War led the way to a wonderful victory in the Cold War. By the way, if you look at who's heading the peacekeeping force in Kabul, Afghanistan today, last time I checked, it was a German three-star. That's a NATO operation. So NATO is not irrelevant. The old Europe still needs to help us. And the deliberate attempt to shoot ourselves in the foot by dismissing these people with contempt has been a, you know, a manifestation of this kind of arrogance that this administration has shown in conducting its foreign affairs.
And Iraq is the military centerpiece of the administration's foreign policy, General McPhee?
Well, I think this is a deep and complicated subject, Tom, and so it's hard to deal with it in bumper sticker terms.
Well, let's go past the bumper sticker.
Well, look, the war in Afghanistan was above all a proper, in my view, others may disagree, a proper reaction to 9/11. We attacked al-Qaeda that had planned and executed the 9/11 attacks. We took down a government that supported openly the al-Qaeda agenda. That all made a lot of sense. We got worldwide support for that. It was done under a UN mandate. People applauded during that process. Almost none of those observations apply to the Iraqi adventure. We didn't plan it properly. It didn't have international support. It failed to get a UN resolution. We made hopelessly naive assumptions about what would happen in the aftermath of, quote, victory. You know, when the president declared victory or the end of major combat operations, it was only the start of other combat operations. So this effort has been mismanaged from beginning to end. When Chaz Freeman says we admire competence, what he means is we're professionals. We've done this for a living, and we know that the test here is, do you know what you're doing? The removal of Saddam Hussein was a good thing to do, but knowing what needs to be done is only a one-club bid. You have to know how to do it. And this administration has certainly plainly demonstrated that they don't know what they're doing.
Avis Boland, let me put to you some of what I'm sure you're going to hear. A, you're politically partisan. What is this, a kind of camouflaged forward guard for the Kerry campaign? B, you're out of date. This is the old guard view. It doesn't meet the needs of the time. And C, your group, your gang, your generation didn't fix the world problem, so step aside.
Well, I think the first charge can be answered by just looking at the list of people who were involved in this. They're Republicans, they're Democrats, they're independents. I think we all are united in feeling that the present course cannot continue.
Though some are clearly identified as supporters of Senator Kerry already, including General McPhee, I understand.
Some are, a great many others aren't. But
right.
This is not a partisan operation, and
okay.
We took great care not to label it as a Kerry thing. But more importantly, your second point that we're out of date. I don't think that it is out of date to have allies. I think General McPeak put it extremely well. America has traditionally led by working with allies, by working with NATO allies, with our Asian allies, with a large group of countries across the world. And this has just been thrown out the window by this administration. If you remember the outpouring of support that came after 9/11, when people were putting flowers in front of our embassies and the most rabid anti-American French newspaper said, we're all Americans today. And what happened to that? Within a year, it had been dissipated by this overweening arrogance. I think this is what is out of date, is the idea that you can do anything without allies in the world. You can go so far alone, but then you are stuck as we are in Iraq today.
So here we've got a kind of cry from the heart from professionals who have been there and say it's not going right, but you know there is and will be pushback to your pushback. I want to get a taste of that right now. Joining us from Washington, Andrew Apostolou is Director of Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Good evening and welcome, Andrew Apostolou.
Yes, good evening. How are you?
I'm very well. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. You may not have seen the statement yet. I don't know if anyone has, but you've seen the reports of what's going on here. What do you think of the line of attack that these retired high-tier diplomats and military brass are bringing to bear on the Bush foreign policy? They say it's got to go. What do you say?
Well, it's up to Americans to decide whether or not the Bush foreign policy goes. It's none of my business. You know, you stopped letting us run your country in 1776. But let me just say that I heard some of the biographies read out, and I was very interested by them. Because it struck me that none of the people who are talking this evening, nor have appended their names to this letter that's coming out tomorrow, bothered to resign or issue a public letter in March 1991, when the first Bush administration, after having encouraged Iraqis to rise up against Saddam, allowed Saddam to come back from the grave and mow them down. Nor did they resign over Iran-Contra nor issue a protest. And you'll recall Iran-Contra involved paying off Iranian terrorists and promoting the worst elements in Latin America.
Well, shall we take from that they see this as...
Let me just say, I think what that shows is that this is, I'm afraid, and we've had this in Britain too, the last gasp of the dinosaurs of realpolitik, and I'm afraid their era is over.
So give us a substantive, then, reply to their critique that there's been damage done to the United States' standing in the world, the image of competence, the image of trustworthiness, the image of a worthy ally.
Well, are you telling me that we should have allowed Saddam Hussein to remain in power in flagrant violation of the UN resolutions to get away with what he'd got away with? Are you telling me that we should have done nothing about al-Qaeda in Afghanistan? Of course not. The fact is, working through allies in the 1990s, working through Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, failed dismally in Afghanistan, and that's one of the reasons why we had the problem with al-Qaeda. So I think the idea that we should just sit back and listen to what some of these dodgy states that these people had the misfortune to represent the U.S. in as saying to us, it is an absurd policy. It's about time that we closed in on countries like Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. I mean, during the 1980s and 1990s, AQ Khan was happily proliferating. What did the U.S. do? Nothing.
And what about the argument that an image of overweening arrogance is turning away allies that the United States, with all its power, needs to prevail in the war on terror, just for starters?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry to remind you, but you've had an image of arrogance for some time simply for being the wealthiest and most powerful country in the world. And I remember myself demonstrating against your policies in the 1980s, especially in Latin America. You're not going to please everybody all of the time. And the idea that the U.S. is somehow popular before President Bush became president, I think, is absolutely bizarre. People have clearly forgotten the Cold War when around half the globe was against you.
Charles Freeman, what about it? Here, the accusation that comes back is you all are the dinosaurs of realpolitik. You left the world in quite a state yourselves. The Bush administration is trying to do something different about it. What's wrong with that?
I think it's very entertaining rhetoric, but it comes from someone who's, as far as I can tell, never been on the front line serving this country.
I'm not an American.
I don't understand exactly what he's saying. I think the basic point is, if you look at issues like Iraq, that you don't send the soldiers in before you've exhausted the diplomacy. You don't leave the soldiers holding the bag. One of the things that distresses me the most about what is happening in Iraq is the virtual destruction of the U.S. Army through its brutalization and an occupation for which it was never prepared. It was sent into a theater of war with no planning for what would be done after it won the virtually inevitable victory over a weak Iraqi opposition. And we are suffering the consequences for that. All of this is what's happening today. It's not what happened in 1991 or 1983 or 1977 or any of those dates in the past. The problems that we confront today in Iraq, the difficulties we've had concerting an effective response to North Korean proliferation, the difficulties we've had in concerting a similar response to Iranian proliferation, the essential default on the peace process between Israelis and Palestinians, and the propensity of the world to rise up in opposition to anything we say. For example, Greater Middle East Democracy Initiative becomes the greatly diminished Middle East democracy bleat at Sea Island. All of this is testimony to the fact that there are very real problems with American leadership at present.
Andrew Apostolou, incompetence and setbacks.
Well, I'm sorry, but the problems in Iraq do not stem from last year. They stem from the fact that you did not finish the job in 1991. As I said before, that's because you practice realpolitik, and that's because at the time, you'll recall a gentleman called Dick Haas, who was briefly in this administration, is now the Chancellor on Foreign Relations, said at the end of the war, our policy is Saddam's regime without Saddam. And unfortunately, the notion that it is acceptable to leave dictatorships in place in any part of the world, especially strategically important parts of the world, such as the Middle East, was, I'm afraid, the policy of this country for many, many years. It wasn't the policy of many of people abroad. It wasn't the policy of people of Europe on the left. And fortunately, we now have a U.S. administration that's finally agreeing with us. We finally have a U.S. administration that's woken up to this fact. It took the tragedy of September 11 for that to happen. It's very sad, but I'm sorry to say that for too many years, you did, as President Bush, I think, rightly put it rather well, actually, buy your stability at the price of other people's liberty. And they don't like that.
Meryl McPeak, what do you say to this argument? It just didn't work. Realpolitik may look good. It may look like a tradition. It's got a lot of history, but it simply wasn't working.
Well, Tom, nothing in international affairs is as easy as it ought to be. But some of these criticisms by Andrew sound to me hopelessly naive and out of touch. To say that this group that is coming out against the Bush administration foreign policy has been responsible for bigger mistakes is laughable. There's not been a bigger disaster. U.S. national interests have not been set back to this extent any time in my memory. So I think we don't have to pay much attention to what Andrew says. He's not in touch with what's going on. A more interesting criticism is that some of us are already, including, as you said, me, are already associated with the Kerry campaign. And that is true in my case. I'm a supporter of Senator Kerry. But I should say that's not the whole story. When I retired 10 years or so ago, went to Oregon, I registered as a Republican. In 1996, I was the Oregon chairman of the Dole Kemp campaign. In the year 2000, I was a veteran for Bush. In fact, I took quite a bit of flack for it. Had to appear on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer and answer why senior military guys should be up there supporting candidate Bush. So it just won't wash to say that because, you know, I made a mistake, in other words, in 2000, and I've learned about it quite rapidly after that. And now, by the way, I'm a registered independent in Oregon. But this sort of criticism that we're all left-wing pinko Democrats just won't work with this group.
Andrew Apostolou, we've just got a minute before.
I didn't call them left-wing pinko Democrats.
We've got that rightly. But here's the question. The Bush administration has made some changes. Do you see the Bush administration itself backing a bit off the more aggressive posture that it struck right after 9/11 as it moved toward Iraq?
Again, you say the more aggressive posture it struck after 9/11. In fact, in 1998, your government decided that the overthrow of Saddam's regime was your official policy, and there was a thing called the Iraq Liberation Act. So President Bush was simply moving forward to bear down on that regime that was in flagrant violation of its UN obligations and has thrown out the arms.
Well, one thing to state, another thing to go into the 150,000 troops.
I'm sorry to point this out, but Tony Blair had, before President Bush even came to office, made it clear that Britain would take serious action against Saddam Hussein. So let's not overly politicize this. There's nothing wrong with supporting John Kerry. And in fact, I think Mr. Kerry's policy stance on Iraq is a very sensible one. It's not terribly different to President Bush's.
Well, it's a political year, a presidential year, so the politics will be here. Andrew Apostolou, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much,
Director of Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We're talking with retired top brass diplomat and military against the Bush foreign policy. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about an outbreak of former senior U.S. diplomats and top military brass calling for an end to the my way or the highway Bush foreign policy, and in fact, an end to the Bush presidency. My guest tonight, General Meryl McPeak, retired Air Force General, Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force 1990 to 1994. Avis Bolin, the top official in the U.S. State Department, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, 89 to 91, Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, 99 to 02, and Ambassador Charles Freeman, Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, 93 to 94, Ambassador to Saudi Arabia, 1989 to 1992. They are just three of a couple of dozen very high-ranking officials from the State Department, from diplomacy, from the military, retired now, most of them, who are saying this should stop. What do you think? With the new UN resolution on Iraq in his pocket, has the president proved his critics wrong? Does this sound like a stunt for the Kerry campaign or the genuine alarm of veteran soldiers and statesmen? A failure? Are these men and women looking backward or looking out for America's best interests? Is it time to throw the brakes on Bush foreign policy or time to carry on? We're at 1-800-423-8255. William is calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Hi. Hello. Still there?
Yes, you're right on.
Good. I'm on a cell phone, so I may break up here in a minute.
We've got you loud and clear.
Well, okay. Fine. First of all, I served with General McPeak in the Pentagon in the early 90s, and I certainly applaud General McPeak and several things that he did, particularly the uniform issue, which kept everybody distracted while you totally reorganized the Air Force. I thought that was a beautiful thing. But on point here, if you will.
Yes.
It seems that all of your guests seem to have at least touched the Clinton administration, which I find interesting.
Well, is that a taint in your mind? They also touched the Reagan administration,
I don't
Bush
know,
one?
They touched Bush one, but principally I think in the majority of it has touched the Clinton administration, which I find interesting. Also,
I should say, as I look across this whole list, I'm not sure that's true across the entire list, but they're there too. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, okay. The point is, I do think that we have a grand strategy for the Mideast. It's not necessarily articulated. It may be something like NSC 68, and some of your folks remember NSC 68. Not as grand as that, but certainly some sort of strategy that says, let's get in there and get a position politically and geographically where we can do something. It seems like we are, in fact, doing that. We are there within proximity of many of the issues, and we have not only diplomats, but, of course, if necessary, some clout to help make our point and to safeguard ultimately the United States.
William, let's get some response on that from Charles Freeman, former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. Charles Freeman, the notion that at least the Bush administration, too, is getting the shovel in there. It's moving things around.
Well, that was one of the six somewhat self-contradictory reasons that were given for this war. The problem with it is that far from having been welcomed and established a secure position in Iraq, we have established a very precarious position, and the main issue that was between us and the incoming interim administration in Iraq was whether they had the right to tell us to leave or not. Probably Iraqi nationalists, if they want to establish their credentials, are going to have to ask us to leave. In the meantime, it's certainly true that we have rearranged things quite a bit. We've withdrawn from Saudi Arabia. So we're withdrawn meaning withdrawn our active forces there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We have still got a training mission in Riyadh, both with the Army and a cross service group called U.S. Military Training Mission.
But increasingly withdrawing Americans generally in recent weeks as
well. Well, I think actually there are broader issues in Saudi Arabia, which include Al Qaeda getting what it has wanted, which is a very rapid drawdown in the American presence across the board, not just military, but civilian. But the main point is, in Iraq, we've done a great favor to the Iranians. We've flattened their main enemy, and we have pleased some Israelis, no doubt. But I don't think anybody in Iraq or anywhere else in the region imagines that we're going to be able to hang on there for very long. The way in which we entered the place wasn't exactly the best way we could have done it.
So they're engaged, but not engaged in a way that looks like a long-term winner to you. William, thanks for your call. Richard's call on the line. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm calling just to say that I'm really pleased to hear that somebody's finally speaking out against what this administration's been doing. I remember when he did the State of the Union address talking about the axis of evil, I was kind of appalled at that attitude. But I am a little bit disappointed that it took so long for somebody to say something about this.
So you're saying, where were you guys and gals 2 years ago?
Exactly. But, you know, I would like to congratulate them and, you know, say that I am happy that they're doing this now.
Richard, we've got it. Avis Bolin, how about it? There's a thank you, but also a hey, what took so long?
Well, we appreciate the vote of support there. But I think for most of us, speaking critically of the president of an administration is not something that we are accustomed to doing. We've been professionals all our lives. We follow U.S. policy. We try to give our voices as best we can, our views as best we can within the administration. But once a decision is taken, it has been our professional training to support that.
And now
not
you're changing
to be critical
your spots
publicly.
And now you've come around on that.
Well now we are all actually out of the service. And I think we have felt impelled by events, by the reckless nature of the Bush foreign policy, to indeed speak out and to say that this really cannot go on without major damage to U.S. national interests, to as Chaz Freeman has just said, to our position in the Middle East. We are not stronger there than we were before Iraq. We're in a very precarious position.
Let's try and get more call. Avi's calling from Edison, New Jersey. Hi, Avi. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not top brass. I'm not a diplomat. I'm just a layman plumber.
Okay.
A layman plumber is having a tremendously difficult time with people that are trying to lean on a UN that presided over two massive massacres in Africa. UN that presided over 17 resolutions, not acting, just talking. Talk doesn't cut it.
So what about Bush foreign policy? Are you for it or against it, Avi?
I'm going to get there. You're looking for support from Jacques Chirac that had his hands deep in Saddam Hussein's pocket for money. George Bush policy at least acted. There are problems, but at least somebody is trying to do something. No, it's not perfect. Yes, there are things that could be adjusted. But nobody for the last 20 years has acted on some massive massacres in Africa, some 17 resolutions in the UN that all it was is talk.
Avi, we got it. Our time is short. I'm going to put it to Charles Freeman, Ambassador Freeman. Here's the notion. Avi puts it through the UN in Africa. But the general idea, after 9/11, we need to get some dynamite in here and mix things up a little more. We need some more fundamental approach.
After 9/11.
Yes, sir. What do you say to that?
After 9/11, we had the most remarkable support from the international community, speaking directly and through the UN, that we could possibly have hoped for. I think Tony McPeak mentioned that when we went into Afghanistan, that was with the strong backing of the United Nations. The UN is many things. It's a forum for the international community to articulate its views in. It's the Supreme Court of international law. It's a legislature for international rules and regulations, and it's a technical agency that will carry out programs like development or nation building. It does what its members want. Basically, what we did was tell three-fourths of the members to go to hell. And when we couldn't get the resolution we thought was right in the Security Council, we decided to enforce the will of the court as we interpreted it by organizing a lynch mob.
And now a gang of the old guard is saying enough is enough. This has got to change. Thanks to each of you for joining us tonight, sharing the view. We'll look forward to reading the full statement tomorrow morning. General McPeak, thanks for being with us
tonight.
Okay,
Tom.
And Secretary Bolin, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And Ambassador Charles Freeman in Washington, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
There it is. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the unconventional advice to college graduates hoping to leave their mark on the world. This is On Point. It's graduation season, and all over America, members of the class of 2004 are getting advice from all sorts of keynote speakers about how to make the world a better place But to New York writer Daniel Axt, most commencement addresses are way off base. In this radio diary, he says the key to saving the world is to go out and make a pile of money.
If you're newly graduated from college, you may be wondering right about now just how you're going to save the world. Joseph Campbell might have suggested you follow your bliss, whatever that means. Thoreau would urge that you go confidently in the direction of your dreams. But if you really want to make the world a better place, I can tell you how. Just go out and make the most money you possibly can. Then, if you still want to do more, go a step further and give it away. Anything else you do is selfishness and vanity. Face the fact that if you embark on a career as a poet or a social worker, you're doing it because you like it, because it makes you feel important, and because you don't have the stomach to do some really major good. That would require making piles and piles of dough. I know this sounds callous, so instead of trying to prove the case by cold, hard logic, let me tell you a story. This is the tale of a couple of ambitious young men who graduated from an Ivy League university way back in the Paleolithic year 1978. One, we'll call him Dan, idealistically chose a career in journalism, hoping eventually to transcend even this sainted calling in order to write novels. The other, whom we'll call Alex, descended to the nethermost reaches of Manhattan to seek his fortune in the securities business. How have they fared since college? Fast forward 25 years. Dan has been a newspaper man, published a couple of well-received novels, and now spends his days typing away industriously, undeterred by the world's indifference to his work. Alex, meanwhile, made several $100 million. In fact, Alex is retired from business and spends his time running the foundation he set up with some of his money. When he dies, a good hunk of the rest will go the same way. Now, my question for all you budding video artists and sociologists is, who ended up doing more to make the world a better place, Dan or Alex? It's hard to argue with Alex's foundation, but Alex was improving the world long before he devoted himself and his wealth to philanthropy. By treating his employees well, he helped them and their families live better and no doubt longer lives, since affluence and longevity are correlated. He also helped make the securities markets more efficient, which benefits everyone, especially the present and future retirees, the middle-class families, the colleges, and other non-plutocrats who make up so much of the market nowadays. Alex didn't meet a lot of widows and orphans in his work, but what he did almost certainly improved their lot. For doing so, Alex was magnificently remunerated, which only makes the rest of us richer. Economics, remember, is not a zero-sum game. Creating and amassing wealth fuels productivity growth, which leads to expanding affluence and social progress. Of course, Alex paid enough income taxes over the years to cover the cost of a small army of social workers. And don't forget the foundation. The conclusion is unavoidable. If you have a good education, you shouldn't just consider getting rich. You have an absolute moral obligation. Do it and take comfort not just in financing public services, but in knowing that you're giving people what they want or need, generating jobs, and underwriting the affluence that makes art, justice, environmental protection, and other social goods possible. Is it really so terrible that making yourself a pile of money is good for you too? You'll live in a better neighborhood, drive a safer car, get to be choosier in selecting a spouse, and enjoy a longer, healthier life. Your kids will even get a better education, which will equip them to improve the world even further. Most selfishly of all, you'll avoid the fate that the novelist Robert Musil warned of when he wrote that, in every profession that is followed not for the sake of money, but for love, there comes a moment when the advancing years seem to be leading into the void.
And there's a view. I say follow your bliss wherever it leads. Daniel Axt is a novelist and business columnist. He lives in New York's Hudson Valley. Listeners, do you have a story that would make a good radio diary? If so, we would like to hear from you. Our email address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.